Hello and welcome to Patron Saints, a show about saints for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and normally on this show, I'm taking a look at the myths and religions of the world and seeking inspiration in them for fantasy role-playing games. At present, we are between seasons. Because I have a big journey coming up, I don't want to start our next season about Phoenician mythology until after I get back. And that means I'm doing one-shot episodes on subjects requested by the patrons. And this episode is brought to you by patron and friend of the show, Steve. Steve asked me to talk about saints, and there's a lot to talk about in saints, and so we're only going to focus on some aspects of the role of saints. We're just going to have to limit ourselves, right? There are traditions in a wide range of different faiths of holy people who we might call saints. But for my purposes, we're mainly going to talk about the tradition of saints in Western Christianity, especially in the Middle Ages, because first, that, I think, is the tradition that's most influential on fantasy gaming, although others also are, of course. And second, because it's the one that I know the most about, because my specialty is the history of early medieval Britain, and so the Christianity of that period is very important to that history. So, to begin with, let's talk about what exactly is a saint in this tradition. You may be thinking of the various rules and gradations of sainthood, you know, this person is blessed, but that person's actually a saint, all this stuff that exists in modern Catholicism. The Christian tradition of venerating saints dates right back to the early days of the religion, and most early saints, not all but most early saints, were martyrs. They were commemorated by the communities they had been part of after they had been killed by the locals or by the imperial authorities or whoever. And typically that sainthood emerged from the communities that these people had been specifically associated with, and as a result, many cults were highly local, and there were some that did spread across the Christian community, whether that was because the individual's influence had already spread across the Christian community because, you know, many of these people were church leaders in some form, or because the cult spread after their death for whatever reason. And these saints were venerated partly because they were seen as exemplary holy people who, you know, showed good examples of how to live a Christian life, but also partly because they were understood to be able to intercede with God on behalf of the believers. If you needed something, you might be able to get a saint to speak to God on your behalf about it. The precise nature of saintly intercession is complex in Christian theology, but also I want to suggest that we are maybe, in the case of most cults of saints, we're dealing with a tradition that exists both in folk and in institutional forms. So the exact way that the institution chooses to conceive of this in terms of theology may not be the way in which most people actually approach it in terms of their daily worship. I don't know when exactly the idea of a patron saint develops, but it is probably pretty early on. There are particular saints that you pray to because of their relationship to a particular concept. Now, the relationship between the saint and the concept can be pretty loose, and it doesn't necessarily have to have much to do with the historical facts of their life, as you may remember from our episode about Santa Claus, where a story about Saint Nicholas of Myra helping out three poor young women evolves into the idea that Saint Nicholas is especially generous, which evolves into his association with gift-giving, which evolves into his association with Santa Claus, which is to say that he is Santa Claus, but also other people are Santa Claus. Santa Claus is very complicated. You can listen to that episode if you want to know more about what I think about it. Anyway, consider, for example, St. Clement of Rome. Not to be confused with St. Clement of Alexandria, St. Clement of Rome is the one that has the Basilica of San Clemente in Rome, which I recommend if you're ever in Rome, actually, or at least when I went there. It was really fascinating and a pretty brief visit. Anyway, as I was saying, he's a patron saint of sailors, and he's a patron saint of sailors because he was martyred by drowning, which you wouldn't think would necessarily be a great recommendation as a patron of sailors. But these things work, I don't know how, right? Is it just association of images? Is St. Clement the patron of sailors just because his symbol is a cross combined with an anchor? It seems like it makes sense, but I couldn't actually prove it. So as I said earlier, the modern Catholic Church has a complex system of rules and regulations for determining who is and isn't a saint. And who gets made a saint can vary depending on the Pope, right? Pope John Paul II famously loved saints and I think made more saints than the last however many popes combined. You know, he felt that the cult of saints was an important part of the everyday worship of ordinary Catholics. But other popes have different ideas, etc. You know, there are whole departments for assessing whether someone is ready for sainthood. And of course, these things are political as well. This actually is true in the region where I grew up, where there was an ongoing debate about whether Father Junipero Serra should be sainted. And I think he has missed his window. I think he's probably not going to get sainted because of Spanish colonialism. So maybe some future pope will reconsider. But in the period that I'm primarily concerned with, the system was much more decentralized. It wasn't so much that the church established the cults of saints as that it recognized existing cults. And sometimes it didn't even do that. Cults just developed, not necessarily organically. I'm not saying that it wasn't done by somebody, but just that that somebody wasn't in the Vatican. Indeed, it's not till like the 9th or 10th century that the Vatican recognizes the cult of a saint that isn't in Italy. Not that the Vatican was against the cults of saints outside of Italy, it just didn't think it was its job, if that makes sense. However, the criteria that it uses in terms of thinking about who's a saint are loosely kind of similar, even if they were applied in a much less systematic fashion. So the saint is supposed to be someone who first has demonstrated exemplary sort of religious virtue. A phrase that often gets used is heroic virtue, and also someone who is capable of intercession. That is, someone who is associated not just with being an exceptionally pious person, but with performing miracles. And I'm talking about miracles typically after they have died, although not always. Now, one thing that is very noticeable about saints in the period that I study, and throughout much of the Middle Ages, is that people engage with them in ways that are very physical. So it's not that people like to pray to these saints or pray thinking about these saints to God, or live lives inspired by the examples of these saints. They want to touch them and be close to them. So that could involve, most commonly, touching parts of their bodies, what are called relics. And these relics could be in the form of a complete body. You know, the saint is buried in this church and we go and visit the grave. That's a very common form of devotion. Or it could be a partial one. So for example, if you're ever in Budapest and you go to St. Stephen's Cathedral, you'll see that they have the hand of St. Stephen, right? The skeletal hand. So it's not even a complete body, but that's still a significant relic. Now, you don't get to touch the actual hand of St. Stephen. It's in a jeweled case. You could get to touch a secondary relic. So an example of a secondary relic would be something like clothing, or they would wrap and rewrap the body of a saint in shrouds. You might get a piece of the shroud, or even the water that had been used to wash them. This is also true with sort of objects that are seen as holy. The point that I'm making is that saints are a physical presence in the landscape, and it's their physical proximity that matters, or that's certainly one of the things that matters. And that physical presence, of course, could be divided into different pieces. So for instance, St. Oswald is a bit like this. I'm going to use a lot of English saints as my examples, because those are the saints that I know the most about. So St. Oswald was cut to bits by the pagans after his defeat by them. And those different bits, and I don't know if this story exists to explain why different churches have different relics of St. Oswald, or if it's actually true. Part of him was buried in Lincolnshire. And then in the 900s, the Mercians, Athelflaed, the Lady of the Mercians, decides that she doesn't like his bones being in Lincolnshire because the Vikings are on top of them. And so she's going to go and retrieve them and take them to Gloucester. Now, you might think of this as, you know, an attempt to preserve a saint's relics from a pagan enemy, but you also might think of this as a Mercian attempt to appropriate a saint primarily associated with a different part of the country. Speaking of a different part of the country, his head is in Durham. So different parts of St. Oswald are in very different parts of England. Now, having said that, it's not always being stolen or retrieved by a party of adventurers that sees a relic being moved from place to place. It's also a gift that you can give. So it's traditional when a new church is being established for a relic to be buried under the altar. And sometimes these would be given as sort of symbols of friendship from one church to another, it's not uncommon for relics to be sort of subdivided. We're going to cut off a piece of this cloth. We're going to take a bone or two from this body. Now, maybe those are gifts and maybe sometimes they're compelled because, of course, the removal of these bones is not always voluntary. I'm sure I've talked about this before, but there are lots of cases of relics being removed without the consent of the church that held them. You could argue that's maybe what happens with St. Oswald, but it's also famously why, you know, the bones of St. Mark are in Venice instead of in Egypt, and why the bones of St. Nicholas are in Bari, in Italy, rather than in Myra, where he was actually from. And this underlines that important point about physical proximity. It's not enough to have a church dedicated to St. Nicholas. It's not enough to pray to St. Nicholas or believe in St. Nicholas or read about St. Nicholas. You have to have something physical, something that you could touch. So saints are a physical, active presence in the world. They're still involved in people's lives, even though they're dead. And that is an extreme case of the general medieval Christian view of the relationship between the living and the dead, which is that relationship is ongoing. The dead continue to be an active presence. They can affect you by you praying to them and getting intercession from them. But also, if we're talking about people who aren't saints, you can affect them by praying for them, because you can help them get into heaven, praying for their soul. So the medieval Christian view of the world is one where prayer bridges the gap between this world and the next world. The dead are still around, and sometimes ghosts or apparitions of the dead will appear to tell you to, I don't know, stop expropriating land from monasteries. That's a very common thing that the dead come back to tell people in historical texts, primarily written by monks. But joking aside, there is a transition, and it's associated with, but not necessarily identical to, because it also happens in Catholic places, the Reformation, where as the Middle Ages comes to an end, this sense of the activity of the dead diminishes, and we start to get a view of the dead that is more focused on commemoration. The classic illustration of this, and it is slightly out from the Reformation, it starts a bit earlier, is the transition from gravestones saying, pray for the soul of so-and-so, to saying, in memory of so-and-so. So we're before that in a landscape which has that ongoing relationship. And so, as a result, the resting places of saints can become major sites of pilgrimage. So in the UK, that's obviously St. Cuthbert, St. Albinus, and later on in the Middle Ages, St. Thomas of Canterbury. Because of their importance as pilgrimage destinations, these burial places can become very important to churches. So for example, if you look at the historical development of the original cathedral in Winchester, Old Minster, the burial of St. Swithin is originally outside the church, and then the Old Minster keeps getting expanded toward it until eventually the tomb is inside the cathedral. And of course, the secular powers have to get in on the act. Winchester was a major recipient of royal patronage, and Swithin is a saint who's sort of associated with the royal house of Wessex. And these dynasties wind up with patron saints, sometimes more than one patron saint. So in Mercia, that could be St. Whiston, who's buried at Repton, which puts another spin on the Vikings building this fortress, well, not even building, but adapting the church into this fortress at Repton, right? This site that is essentially sacred to the royal house of Mercia. In East Anglia, that's St. Edmund, or maybe St. Athelthryth, right? Like, there's a couple of candidates. In Wessex, as I mentioned, St. Swithin, and in Northumbria, St. Cuthbert. So the different polities within what is today England all pretty quickly get a saint to be associated with, and that is sometimes somebody who is actually a member of their royal family, or sometimes a cult who they adopt. And St. Cuthbert in particular is an interesting one for Northumbria, because St. Cuthbert is also a very important cult in Scotland. So maybe your rule used to be based on your descent from Woden, but now it can be justified by the patronage of a royal saint. You don't have to lose the sacred component of your kingship just because we're no longer believing in a king of the gods who went around having a bunch of mortal children. And of course, that relationship benefits the church, because having a royal saint in your church means royal patronage. So these are very high status saints. But there are also local saints, or saints that are particular to a certain region, or, well, I'll give you an example. So I used to live on a little side street in Cambridge, just off of Trumpington Street. It's called St. Botolph's, and the building that I lived in was called the St. Botolph's Building. And that is because it is across the street from the cemetery of St. Botolph's Church. St. Botolph, located right by what was, in the Middle Ages, one of the main entrances to the city of Cambridge. And St. Botolph, as a patron saint of travelers, it makes sense that his church would be close to a city gate, but also it's a relatively uncommon dedication. There's definitely one in London. There's other ones in East Anglia, I think. And then there's also some in Scandinavia, and then that's kind of it. I believe he is a local saint picked up by Scandinavians and taken back there in kind of like the Viking Age, I guess. But to be honest, I don't know very much about the actual St. Botolph, or St. Botwolf, I guess is probably his actual name. Anyway, it's a very rare dedication. So if you walk into a medieval city and you stop someone and say, hey, where can I find St. Botolph's? You're probably not going to get an answer. Whereas if you said, where can I find St. Peter and St. Paul or St. Mary? They'll say, which one? Cambridge has two St. Mary's churches very close to each other, Great St. Mary and Little St. Mary, and probably some other ones. But if you were to ask for, you know, where's St. Michael, where's St. Martin, you would be very likely to find them. You don't think much about St. Martin today, but he was hugely popular with medieval aristocrats because, I think largely because of the way he's depicted, which is as a soldier on horseback, which is to say that he's a saint who is a quote-unquote knight. And never you mind that his whole deal was that he gave up being a soldier. He shows that you can be a chivalrous warrior and also a good Christian. Obviously, the medieval aristocracy likes them. And in some cases, they can be commemorated only in one church. So if you go to Bampton in Oxfordshire, there's a church there dedicated to St. Bjornwald. And I believe that is the only St. Bjornwald there is. He was, I think, the abbot of the monastery that was eventually replaced by this church, St. Bjornwald's in Bampton. So he's just not particularly important other than his founding of this church, which means that if you're playing a medieval game and the characters come into a town and they discover that there is a church dedicated to a saint they've never heard of, they're not going to think, who's this guy? Never heard of him. Sounds fishy. They're going to think, okay, another little local saint whose cult never spread beyond this particular church. So this gives you lots of opportunities for local stories about miracles, relics that could be stolen by unscrupulous types, all that sort of thing, without having to worry about messing with the continuity of some really well-known mainstream saint. It's also true that saints are sometimes interfaith figures. So to step outside of the strictly Christian paradigm, there are holy figures who are shared by multiple faiths, even if they might not be saints properly so-called. So you see this a lot in the Middle East, where in the Middle Ages there are these shrines called maqams, which you get in places like Palestine, I think all in that whole region generally, but they are often said to be the burial places of figures like, you know, this one is where Moses is buried or whatever. And because of the importance of this figure to the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim communities, they can sometimes act as sort of neutral ground. There are times in the Middle Ages where these intercommunal sacred sites function as places where people can be safe because they are respected by all of those religious communities. So, okay, saints in your game. Now, a lot of people have said that saints fulfill a similar role to a pantheon of gods in a polytheistic society, and in a sense, I guess that's true. It's true in some ways. You know, if you've got neurological problems, you pray to St. Vitus, and if you're an expectant father, you pray to St. Joseph, and if you've got a headache, you pray to, I think, St. Blaise. I'd have to look it up. But a lot of the marquee saints still do get general requests for intercession or spiritual healing that don't particularly have anything to do with their portfolios, right? The precise categorization of patron saints is really something that comes along later, and people pray to St. Thomas for relief from all kinds of problems, even though he has no association with those problems. As I mentioned before, you could have each local village have a legend about a particular saint. You could have your paladin be dedicated to an order that venerates a certain saint and, like, try to live up to his example. So this could be like a purely world-building technique. We're trying to communicate the kinds of things that the setting's religion concerns itself with, or you can just have the tomb of a local saint be a good place to hide out from vampires. Relics could be a fun holy resource, especially if you need one to take out that vampire, but they're being kept by a jealous priest who's, you know, either kind of venal and worldly, just wants to keep in the church to collect all the pilgrim money or what have you, or it's just a cautious traditionalist who knows that the relic has been in the church forever and doesn't want a bunch of scruffians taking it out to go fight a vampire and maybe never coming back. One thing that the saint worldview does suggest that isn't common in RPGs is having characters continue to influence the world after they're dead. So like I said, the medieval way of thinking about how the living and the dead interact, and indeed not an uncommon way of thinking about it in many cultures, not just in medieval Europe, is something that isn't very common in role-playing games, and not in terms of the player characters approaching dead people, saints or ancestors or whatever, and asking for some kind of intervention, but actually having the players play those dead people. Now, I'm not saying that you should run a whole campaign where the PCs are just dead saints granting intercession to some people and not to others, but I do think that there's a possible angle where, especially in a game like Pendragon that already has that kind of generational aspect, and especially since there are saints who weren't particularly holy people while they were alive, you could have characters continue to exert some sort of influence over their community, their monastery, their village, their family, their dynasty. You know, if you're the person who's ascended through all of that, like, domain play and become a king or something like that, well, then, you know, maybe you are still venerated after you're gone. Now, that, of course, is presuming that the sainthood thing works more or less the way it works in our world, and also has a supernatural reality, which may not be something you want to do, but, you know, even if the gods aren't going to accept these venal and worldly king types as saints in a world where the gods are, you know, very carefully paying attention to this kind of thing, you know, you probably do have at least a few player characters of exceptional piety who might qualify to represent the divine even in the afterlife. In fact, this kind of ties into the subject of the next Patron Deities episode, in which we're going to talk about mortals who became divine not so much through their goodness as through their greatness. Because on our next episode of Patron Deities, we're going to talk about deified emperors. So I hope that you will join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.